maybe even applying this to the audience of readers and writers, what you're supposed to be reading, what you're supposed to be writing, what you're supposed to be liking.
Absolutely. I was talking to someone just today who is so hyper-focused on word counts. And I'm like, but if the story's only 16,000 words, I've read a New York Times bestseller, an international bestseller, that was only 16,000 words. The point is how long does it take to tell the story? And the story is what we focus on, rather than getting hyper-focused on, well, it should be this many words and this many words. That's what I love about, I'm a self-published author. So I love that I then have that freedom. Mm-hmm. I don't have publishers telling me, oh, it's supposed to be this many words. I don't have to worry about word count. I tell the story because that's what's mm-hmm. important.
Hey, readers and writers. Welcome to episode 129 of Read and Write. Today, we're chatting with author Jessica Smith about how stories and culture define us. And I warn you, it's a big topic. Hi, Jessica.
Oh. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Pretty good. How's your day been?
It's been great. Thank you.
Oh, I'm glad. So before we get started, why don't you go ahead and tell the listeners a bit about yourself?
So my given name is Jessica Smith. Mm-hmm. I'm an author who publishes under the pen name Paula Jean Ferry, mostly because mm-hmm. Jessica Smith isn't searchable online and I wanted some visibility. Right. but I just love stories. I'm obsessed with books and any other form that stories come in. I mean, that mm-hmm. stories come in music and movies and, you know, everyday right. happenings that then become stories.
Stories are all around us.
They're kind of my favorite. Right. So slightly obsessed because everything kind of ties back to it in my mind.
mm-hmm. Like there's that idiom that there is only, what is it? Is there only one story or is there only like three stories that are constantly told over? I don't remember exactly what it's something like that.
I'm actually not familiar with this idiom.
Oh, really? It's something, it basically goes that there is only one story or there are only three stories that humanity has ever told. And everyone is just retelling those stories over and over again.
Makes sense. Seems accurate.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember the number, obviously, but I understand the sentiment of it. Like, as humanity, we are connected together, and there are only, I guess, so many new things that humanity can discover, and that we just want to talk about those things, like, I don't know, love, death, birth, you know, that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So, tell me about your theory about how stories and culture define us.
And that's actually kind of a tricky question because I actually took a class in college that mm-hmm. was all about narrative identity and culture and how the narratives of these two things also kind of shape the narratives. And they're all just kind of interwoven so intricately. Mm-hmm. It's hard to just sum up with just a quick podcast when there's so many other things to really discuss. But a lot of our beliefs come from the culture around us, and the beliefs that we have then shape the culture and the rules and expectations of culture. Mm-hmm. And then we try and find our personal role, our personal identity, and how it kind of fits within that.
Mm-hmm. I remember when you and I first talked about this a couple weeks ago now. I don't know why, but after we got done talking, I couldn't stop thinking about Neil Gaiman's American Gods. It kind of reminds me of that same general idea that culture shapes us, but we're also shaping culture at the same time. And it's just kind of like this big snowball that just kind of keeps going. And it's just like a cycle. It just, you know, we're constantly influencing it. It's constantly influencing us. And then we change together.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that a lot of my professors talked about in my college courses that I was taking, about how art imitates life and life imitates art. And it is just always kind of this endless cycle of growth and change. I mean, yes, the same stories are being repeated, but I feel like they're being repeated with more detail and with more frequency because of how things change around us, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. It's like I was talking, I was working recently with novel themes, like talking about the themes of novels. And there really is, it feels like only like a handful of themes that you work with because they are so universal. But that's just the undercurrent theme. And the novel itself obviously is different every single time, but the undercurrent remains the same.
Oh, yeah. Those are actually kind of my favorite things to read, is when you get a really good story like Pride and Prejudice, and then you look at how many variations of that. It's not just a theme. It's literally the entire story being told from the servant's perspective, being told from, you know, the one of the sister's perspectives, or the zombies. Yeah, exactly. You toss in all these random factors. You see the same thing with fairy tales. How many times have we seen some version of Cinderella, but we love it every time because it's always different. And there's always something that rings so familiar and so true. Like I love fairy tale retellings and like classic story retellings.
It's kind of like a book comfort food is what I was trying to get out. It's like you reach for it because it's a favorite. Ooh. It makes you feel good no matter how many times it's retold or redone.
Yeah, for sure. And it makes so much sense in a world where things are constantly changing and constantly chaotic, because that's the world we live in. You know, there's constant change, and we're with the hyper-connectedness that we have that we just didn't have 100 years ago, where there was so much more steadiness and consistency in life in general. Mm-hmm. We now seek that steadiness and consistency in things like books.
Yeah, I can see that. You wrote your thesis on this, correct?
Yes, I did a senior thesis on how Tourette syndrome specifically affects communication.
Okay.
There's a lot of factors. There's a lot.
No, go ahead.
There's a lot of factors of culture in how we communicate with one another. So looking at how they all interconnect, and like it kind of comes back to what we initially talked about with that narrative identity and culture. Like, what is my identity as a person with Tourette syndrome? What is the narrative in culture? What is my personal narrative? And how do these things all just kind of interconnect, trying to kind of find my place. At the time, I had just been recently diagnosed.
Okay.
So I was mostly just curious about it in general. Like, I had never really heard much about Tourette syndrome, and so I wanted to do this deep dive study and conveniently tie it into my courses that I was taking.
Okay.
So I found some super fascinating stuff. Sorry.
No, keep going.
I was mostly just trying to fill the gap because I forgot about the lag.
This feels very disjointed right now. So
a little bit.
I think delays start starting to get to me and mess with my brain a little bit.
Sorry.
No, it's not. Yeah, your fault. It's the internet's fault. Nothing we can do about the internet, unfortunately. So how do you feel that since we're talking about how stories and culture define us, Did you find that the culture stories around your diagnosis started to define you, or did you try to find a way to actively not let those define you or find a new way to define yourself?
I feel like it actually kind of had the opposite effect where it allowed me to break free of culture because culture is basically unspoken rules of society that help us to function and to facilitate communication to make things easier because it's generally understood. So we don't have to go over every single point of detail. But the thing about these rules, in order to facilitate communication, they have to be something that is going to serve us. Whereas if they don't, culture is a man-made concept and we can then change those rules. So it kind of helped me to realize, oh, these are actually rules that are harming more than they're helping. These rules need to be changed. So it was actually something that changed my personal narrative to something that was much more empowering. Like, oh, I don't have to just sit and react and respond to what's happening. I actually get to step in and to create that narrative and to create those rules. Because with Tourette's syndrome, I looked at, it creates a lot of awkward moments. Not everyone's just going to expect you to bark in the middle of a business meeting or scream in the middle of church. And what happens is there aren't any rules about that because people don't experience that. So it gets awkward. Awkward is basically when there aren't rules that are understood. So we look
That's an
around saying,
interesting way to
uh-oh,
put
I don't
that.
know the rule. I'm an adult. I should know this, right? So we look around as adults, who knows the rule? Who can teach me those rules? And I go, oh, I'm the one that knows what's happening here because I'm the one that's barking. So I can then create that rule. I get to create that story and I get to completely create this narrative and an entire culture around how people react and respond to me instead of saying, oh, well, this is just the rules and how it's supposed to go, thinking that I don't know the rules either. And so I just wait for someone else to do something.
I feel like this topic is very broad. Like, I can see it applying to basically everything in life. And sometimes it makes my brain hurt a little bit just thinking about it. Like, just how far-reaching this topic is, you know?
Yes.
It's like I can apply this
Yeah,
about
for
half a dozen
sure.
things right now. And it's just, I don't know. It's one of the things, like, do you just like, I don't know. I get fuzzy brained thinking about, like, oh my God, it applies to this and then this and then this. And I can't, like, it's hard for me to narrow it down to something to talk about.
Welcome to my life. I've done this for the past, how long have I been out of college? Like 10 years. Oh, and I've slowly taken it. That's part of why I love getting on podcasts because every podcast has a different audience. And I'm like, ooh, let's talk about it with your audience and what you talk about. Let's talk about it from the story aspect. Let's talk about it from the mental health aspects. Let's talk about it from the grieving aspect. That's when a podcast I've done fairly recently where I talked a lot about how much death I've experienced in my family. I've lost 3 out of 4 siblings.
Oh my
And
goodness, I'm so
there was a
sorry.
lot that actually did tie into a lot of, oh, yeah, life, it happens.
It does, but
But a lot of these
still, I
principles
can
were
be human
still
and say
able
I'm sorry.
to tie over. And I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, so it applies to like literally everything. Like, I don't know. Culture defines us, and you can't help but like get swept up in the flow of what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to feel. And then maybe even applying this to the audience of readers and writers, what you're supposed to be reading and what you're supposed to be writing, what you're supposed to be liking.
Absolutely. I was talking to someone just today who is so hyper focused on word counts. And I'm like, but if the story's only 16,000 words, I've read a New York Times bestseller, an international bestseller that was only 16,000 words. I've read books that are, I've read the unabridged version of Les Mis, which has who knows how way too many words. It's 1,000 pages.
God bless you for reading that.
Actually, I think it's closer to like 1,200, but I mean, right? But the point is how long does it take to tell the story? And the story is what we focus on rather than getting hyper-focused on, well, it should be this many words and this many words. That's what I love about, I'm a self-published author. Mm-hmm. So I love that I then have that freedom. I don't have publishers telling me, oh, it's supposed to be this many words. I don't have to worry about word count. I tell the story because that's what's important.
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking, I know sometimes it is easy to get hyper focused on the word count because you have agents who won't even look at it unless it's like a, like for example, the genre of low fantasy, it has to be 90,000 words. Like they won't even look at it if it's above or below, because apparently there's been some market research that says that this is what most readers gravitate towards. Stories is this what the readers expect, because this is what, you know, everything has told them to expect, because now the industry is pushing that. So yeah, everything's defining us. Our own rules are defining us and we don't like them.
Right. And that's super helpful in some ways, knowing, okay, this is about the target that I want to get to, but at the same time, don't put in extra words, because that was the hard part about reading the unabridged version of Les Mis. He talked for like 300 pages about the sewers of France in detail, because one scene takes place in the sewers of France. Not necessary for the story. Don't put it in just to get your word count up. I don't care.
that book
that I was talking about.
Yeah.
This book that I was talking about earlier that was only 16,000 words, you know, that wasn't expected by any means. It wasn't something that, had he pitched it to a traditional publisher, they probably would have rejected. But he had, the author had initially self-published. It was more just something he wrote to be like a card in a way, like a small gift to family and friends. But they kept sharing it and kept sharing it and kept sharing it because of the power of the story. And it was something that they could relate to. And then it got picked up by a traditional publisher because it was doing so well. I mean, to have a self-published book on the New York Times bestseller list was kind of unheard of, because this was in the 90s before Amazon. Right.
Out of curiosity, what book was it?
This book is called The Christmas Box. It's called The Christmas Box by Richard Paul Evans.
I'll have to look it up.
What's it about? I'm Sam. The general gist, I'm more going to talk about the theme than talk about the story, but what caught people's attention was how this woman had lost a child and helping this father to appreciate his child at a time when he was super stressed, which for a lot of people, I mean, especially coming from someone who has lost 3 out of 4 siblings, that really hits home, you know, especially at Christmas time. It's hard to have the holidays without the family that you expect to be there, especially when they were lost very young. And that was just something that just resonated. Like, there are now Christmas box houses for children. He's built it into this entire nonprofit. They're Christmas angel statues, and the Christmas box house is a full nonprofit that he runs. It's amazing to see how it's grown.
That is amazing. I'm happy to hear he's doing well.
Oh yeah. This is an author that I've actually worked with in helping to build my career as an author. So I'm just gonna brag on him for a little bit, because I love what he's done. I'm so impressed with his career. He's written 41 books, and every single one has been a New York Times bestseller. Yeah.
Wow.
So
that's impressive.
Got some amazing books. I'm a huge fan. Right?
Whoa, 41 books. I can barely fathom the amount of time it took him to write 41 books.
It's taken him several years. I mean, again, his first one was published in the early mid 90s, I think, or something like that. His daughter has released three books as an author herself that have also become New York Times bestsellers. But his daughter's about my age, I think. So,
Well, that's I'm still kind of like flabbergasted by 41 books. Like I'm thinking like my first book that I finally got around to finishing took me basically 20 years to do because I started it back in college. And then it's just like you kind of put it aside and put it, I don't know. This is my own story. It has no actually pertaining to anything on the topic or what you're talking about, but just holy crap, 41 books.
Right?
I'm just astounded.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Like, man, good for him.
I mean, but again, where his career started with this small 16,000 word book that just somehow took off. And it was early in his career. It kind of launched him into this professional author status at a fairly young age. I mean, it was just something that he wrote as a Christmas gift for friends and family. He did not expect it to take off like it did.
That's incredible. Okay, let's get back on topic.
Okay.
So, what are your favorite stories in culture in that define us? Can you pick any out?
I mean,
that's not in any of my
and
questions.
This is such a difficult question because, right? Well, it's difficult just because there are so many variations. I mean, stories that we tell in the United States alone vary so much. I mean, they're going to be different from Korea to England to, you know, to Africa. But then when you break it down into, I live in the state of Utah, but I grew up in the state of Nevada. I've lived in the state of Hawaii. And each of those states, while still being part of the same country, had hugely different cultures. And so when we realize how much variation there really is, I think that was a huge eye opener for me, was moving from Nevada to Hawaii and seeing all of these cultural expectations not apply. And all of a sudden I was doing everything wrong. And I'm just like, what is happening? I went into a state of culture shock, which is a real thing because you just expect these things to be true and constant and they're not. So to have particular stories that define a culture varies so much. I mean, even within family to family, I mean, my sister grew up and in my family and then married a guy from our same hometown, but there was still so many differences because we like to eat dinner early and his family ate dinner late. You know, that was the family culture that they then had to create their own family culture. Like it's on such a global scale and then down to such a minute scale that picking individual stories, we don't realize how much control we have on so many different aspects of culture just because it is such a broad range.
I can see that. I mean, one of the fun things is having had two kids and they're still quite small that I'm basically overlaying, you know, traditions on them. Like we're making our own traditions. Like we're taking things from my husband's side and my side and discarding the things that we didn't like or we didn't think fit anymore and making new ones.
Yeah, absolutely. You're creating your own family culture. I don't have a family of my own. I don't have any children, but at the same time, I do have friends and people that I interact with. There's a unique culture in every workplace. And I contribute to that culture. I contribute to this culture with my friends group and understanding those rules are man-made and how we build on them, because they are supposed to be used as tools to facilitate, not hold us back.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I kind of want to use the word culture here. I feel like the culture right now is breaking down cultures and building new ones. Like, it feels like, especially the last year or two, it feels like we're just tearing down things. Like, everybody en masse kind of feels like they're tearing down things that didn't work for them anymore, and they're trying to put in things that work for everyone or work for them or their small cultures, you know? Like, I feel like right now we're in a period of we're trying to change the culture.
Oh yeah, which absolutely makes sense, because there's so much different, even from when I was a kid. Like, I grew up before the internet, you know, mm-hmm. and even just watching in my less than 40, but you know, more than 30 years, I won't give that away. but even in that small span, there's been so much change. Like, of course we're going to need to change things, because the rules no longer apply. They're mm-hmm. they're not something that we're utilizing. But in breaking all of that down, we do have to create new rules and new structure. But mm-hmm. keep in mind that as humans, we have this like kind of programmed into us of there are unspoken rules that I'm just supposed to follow, and we kind of watch for those. Like, this is why anxiety is such a thing right now, is because we don't know what the hell is going on half the time, because we're creating new rules with right. new situations and new circumstances.
Uh-huh. And you never know how that situation is going to turn out. Speaking from someone who has anxiety.
Right. Right. And I think a huge factor with helping my anxiety lessen is I've just kind of started taking this bull in a china shop approach, because mm-hmm. we don't know if it's going to work or not. And I'm just going to do what I want, because I mean, I do what I want anyways, because my Tourette's are just going to randomly scream, or I'm randomly just going to like start flapping my arms around because those are just a couple of my tics and things that I do. And I've seen them turn out a lot better than I thought they would have. So it's given me a lot more confidence to just, you know what, we'll just see what happens and not mm-hmm. have expectations of a specific outcome. So now that I have this bull in a china shop approach, I'm like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make all the mistakes and then we'll fix it. Which, if you think about it, is what we do as writers as well. Uh-huh. Because what we do as writers is we write a story and then we edit it. Mm-hmm. We have an experience and then we tweak it to make it better going forward. I mean, it's basically just taking what we're doing on the page and applying it to real life.
Mm-hmm. I can identify with that. I'm currently editing the last act of my old work. And yes, I can agree with the editing part. I've cut
Which
so many words this week.
I hate editing. It's really not my favorite part.
But it makes the story so much better, because, like, I don't know, I have this propensity of just writing long, winding sentences. I don't know what the instinct is. And then I basically spend 2 days editing a chapter down to, like, breaking each of those sentences down into, like, 3 or 4 sentences. Just, it makes it so much better. Editing works. Editing's there for a reason.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we need to start doing with our life as well. I did that even in my career as an author. I had this college paper that I'm like, you know what? This is really cool stuff. My professors were super supportive, said you really need to get this published. There's nothing like it in the communications field. And so I said, sweet, I'm going to publish it in a book form because I like books. And I had no idea what I was doing. And it took me a year to publish an already finished and completed manuscript, just because I was trying to figure out, well, how do I do this? How do I do this? You know, I was asking all of these questions.
Right.
And then I got addicted to the whole publishing concept. I never understood adrenaline junkies until I hit publish, and I'm like, oh, I get it. This is my life, you know? So with that, I started a second manuscript, and I published a second book. But along the way, I started learning new things and I went, oh, I did that very wrong in my first book. Maybe I should do it this way this time. And I did the same thing with my third book as well. I just kind of blundered ahead, like I said, bull in a china shop, and I published these three poor little books that are kind of subpar in a lot of ways. Like, I love my content, but the presentation is not awesome, and I could have marketed it better. I could have, you know, there's all of these different aspects. And so that's actually how my fourth book came about, was, hey guys, this is all the things I did wrong with self-publishing. Maybe you should not do these mistakes, because nobody told me. I didn't know where to find this information. Even when I looked, I had no idea how to publish.
It's so hard to find that information.
Like, even something like that was new.
That is the thing about writers. You're never, well, I think that's pretty universal with writers. You're never satisfied with your old work. Like, you always want to go back and make it better and fix it and do something else. And so congratulations to you for moving on and going to the next one.
Oh, thank you. I still plan on, I still have plans to go back and fix them eventually.
<Don't we all?
laughs> But at the same time, I'm currently writing two at the same time at this point, and I've got so many more plans.
Right.
So, you know, it's going to be something that I'm able to then do once I don't have to worry about a side job, or, you know, I can afford to pay someone to, hey, by the way, fix this.
Wouldn't that be nice?
We're getting there. We are getting there. It will happen.
A little bit at a time. Yeah, I find the I like your definition of, like, the bull in the china shop approach. Like, I don't think I'm quite the bull in the china shop. I'm kind of like tiptoeing around the china shop, but I'm trying to be observant while I'm doing it and trying not to, I don't know, interact. I don't, that makes it sound like a hermit. I'm trying not to annoy anyone too much as I make my way trying to figure things out. Just in life in general.
Which makes sense. But I'm also starting to associate more with other people who have this bull in a china shop approach. And I'm starting to see there's actually a lot of benefits. I mean, both kinds are needed. Don't get me wrong, but it's just kind of nice to kind of see that opposite side of the story. You know what? Sometimes there's just too much going on. I had a friend who, Facebook gives you like 5,000 friends max, right? And she,
I didn't know that.
A lot of her friends purchase her. Yeah, fun fact. A lot of her friends purchase her products. So what she did was she was trying to get new people who were buying her products to become her friends because they were already requesting it, but she was at her max. So she made this post about, hey guys, I need to make friends, like space for more friends. So you should unfollow me if you don't believe in this. And just this really polarizing post about, very firm on her beliefs. Like, I don't care if you'd like them or if you don't, like, you're welcome to stay, but this is stuff that you're going to start seeing. If you don't like it, bye. And she was able to bring in more of the people that she did want and have less to do with people that she didn't have much in common with.
Okay. I could see that approach working. It goes against, like, almost every grain in my body. Like, I'm definitely the type that stand back and watch, see what other people are doing, and then try to do the right thing.
Which, I mean, right by whose standards? What narrative are you taking with that?
You know, which, probably my own standards.
That is your standards. I'm not questioning that. Right. Which is what's important. Like, you're not supposed to take this friend's stuff. I heard a quote once, when I was still in high school, I was sent around at someone's wedding to, like, get wedding advice for this couple that was getting married in my family.
Okay.
And as I was recording all of these things about advice, the one that really caught my attention is that Advice is just that. It is advice. You are the one that determines if it's good or bad advice, and if it's mm-hmm. something that you use and keep or something that you just forget about. Blew my mind as a teenager.
Yeah, that is actually very good advice.
Right? And it's something that I've lived by. I'm like, okay, that is your opinion. Will that work for me? No, that's okay. But thank you for mm-hmm. your, you know, thank right. you for your support, being willing to help. I appreciate uh-huh. you. But that's not something I'm going to incorporate in my life.
Mm-hmm. I can apply that to my own, I don't know, example I just sort of gave, but like you watch somebody do something, decide you don't like that outcome, so you try to do something else that produces a different outcome, you know? I like that.
Right. And everyone learns different ways. I mean, you obviously learn by watching, whereas I learn by jumping in and experiencing. Like, mm-hmm. I have to fall on my face if I'm actually going to learn a lesson. I do all the wrong things all the time, but even then, sometimes I keep making the same mistakes over and over. Like, I have to see why that was a bad idea and experience right. it to go, oh, okay, got it. I fix it.
Now, see, I'm the type of personality that I don't understand how something works until I have seen all the steps, till I understand all the steps to go together, and then I will try to do that. That's just my personality.
Yeah, everybody's different and everyone's allowed mm-hmm. to learn how they want to learn.
Yeah, I'm currently trying to teach that lesson to my children. Like, just because, like, let's say, like, I have a boy and a girl, just because the sister does something differently, does learn something one way, doesn't mean that's the way the boy has to learn how to do it. And it's really hard Absolutely. Trying to get that idea into them, because like he's younger, so he sees her do it and then that he thinks that's the way it's supposed to be done. And I'd be like, no honey, you could do it this way, or you could do it this way, or you could do it this way. Just do what's easiest for you.
Right, got it. So it always makes me laugh when I see people so frustrated with how math is being taught, because it's being taught differently than when I was in school.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is I did math. It was taught to me the way it was when I was younger, but my brain actually functions better with the way math is taught now. Like, it makes sense to me, and I don't understand why people are so insistent on sticking with this old way. And I'm like, well, yeah, it works, but this works too. And mm-hmm. just because that's easier for you doesn't mean this isn't easier for me. Mm-hmm. I hated showing my work on my math homework as a kid, because I did it different and I got in trouble for not doing it the right way. And I'm like, no, but it still works. I still get the right answer. Why does it matter?
That's actually the beauty of math. I think, you know, they say like all language boils down to math. It's that it's just numbers, and it doesn't matter how you get from, I don't know. I'm going to switch and say A to B. As long as you end up at B, like, it's just math.
Right.
It's the beauty of numbers.
Right? It's fascinating how insistent people are that there's only one right way to do things. And I'm like, mm-hmm. but if that were true, everyone would be living the exact same life and it would just be so boring.
Yes. Yeah, I kind of experienced this recently, and I don't know. I feel like we're just taking all kinds of weird examples and throwing them at this theory. But for example, I was camping with my brother and his wife, and for some reason we were talking about chocolate chip cookie recipes. And everybody, it feels like, is sure that they have the best recipe, that they make the best cookies. And my brother was just like, I haven't found my best cookie yet. And that just threw everybody up and like, what? You have to try mine. You have to try mine. It doesn't make any sense at all to you. I went off on a bit of a tangent there.
I love that. I love that he did that.
That's my brother because for you.
That's all it really is looking at that was, it's an opinion, and he recognizes mm-hmm. that it's an opinion rather than having this belief. It's a belief that we then somehow in our minds translate to become a fact. There is a mm-hmm. difference between facts yeah. and there is a difference between beliefs.
Now I'm trying to think of a way to combine this all back to our topic, but I think we've veered too far from it now.
Welcome to my life. I'm all over the place. Side note, Tourette syndrome comes with a side effect of ADHD sometimes and obsessive compulsive disorder. And I happen to have both. So I will go off on all of these squirrels because I'm just obsessed to see where mm-hmm. this ends up. it's chaotic, but it's so much fun. I love it.
It sounds fun. I mean, it sounds fun from an outside perspective. I'm pretty sure like I could handle like living near you and being your friend, but having you as my like roommate might be a little too far for my personality. You sound lovely, but I don't think our personalities would match for like that close contact on a close term. But that's just me.
I'm not always this eccentric, just for the record. Like it just every once in a while I just get this bee in my bonnet and I'm just like, nope, I have to know. I have to do it.
Okay, well then maybe we could be roommates. In this weird world where I don't know. That went off in a weird place. So anyways.
Welcome.
Yeah. Okay, so tell the listeners about your 4 books, please.
So my first one is that college paper on how Tourette syndrome affects communication. Mm-hmm. I did expand it a little bit from the college paper, and it became a self-help personal development book called Awkwardly Strong and how to utilize awkward moments as a tool for our benefit mm-hmm. rather than an excuse to hold us back. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, I've had a lot of tragedies in my life. So I ended up doing a similar vein with my second book and talking about these hard things and how to heal. And again, how they can be used as a benefit. It's called Tragically Strong.
Okay.
My third one, I also, as I again mentioned earlier, I dealt with a lot of anxiety at one point. And at this point I've conquered so many of my fears. There are still a few in place, but those fears are there and I want to keep them for a reason. Mm-hmm. But fears can also be used as a tool rather than an excuse. And so I have Fearfully Strong as my third book.
I like and the then because you have going.
Oh, thank you. I was like, quite proud of them.
Yeah, I feel so like
it was kind
I,
of
I can,
weird
like,
to switch I, off of that.
I interrupted you at the most dramatic point, apparently. But before we get to the dramatic point, I like that thread of you're strong no matter what you do. Like, I feel like just hearing the titles, I can kind of identify with them just by hearing the titles a little bit. It like gives me a little bit more confidence, you know?
Good. I'm glad. That's what they're designed to do. So makes me feel good that I did my job right.
Congratulations. All right. Book number 4.
My fourth. Thank you. Book number 4. Again, this bull in a china shop approach. I had a lot of friends saying, hey, you published a book. Can you help me publish mine? And so that's not where I want to focus a lot of my time. Like, I don't want to be some kind of book coach. I feel like there's plenty of those. But I took all of that knowledge and those experiences of all the things that I did wrong and things that I couldn't find and that coaches weren't talking about. Mm-hmm. And I put those into a book called Hard Earned Lessons Learned, a guide on what I wish I'd known when self-publishing.
Okay. Had this been like a normal, you're an author, let's talk about your book podcast, I actually probably would have asked you questions similar to that. Like, one of my standard questions is like, so as an author, what's something you think everyone should learn? Just as a person, like what's one thing you've learned as an author that applies to everyone in their lives? I feel like your fourth book would have answered all those questions. Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. I literally wrote a book on it. Uh-huh.
And where can listeners find a copy of those books?
So again, having a pen name, that was part of The reason I did it so that it was searchable. My pen name is Paula Jean Ferri, Ferri being F-E-R-R-I. I had an Italian great grandfather and I just kind of took his name, even though it was a maternal side. But if you search for Paula Jean Ferri, I'm like the first 3-4 pages of Google. I am what pops up.
Oh, nice.
So you could find me that way. Whatever bookstores will carry my book will pop up. You will find my my Medium articles. You will find my social media. You will find press releases. All the cool things that I'm doing. You'll find my website, which is paulajeanferri.com. It's all me. I love it.
It's nice having a unique name like that, isn't it? Or I guess nice using a unique
for sure.
name like
and
that.
That was, and that was something that I talked about in my book was about pen names and kind of how to choose one and to, like, yes, it's good to have the privacy aspect, but for me it was more the visibility aspect. I wanted to be searchable online because I want to tell people, hey, this is where you go to find my books, Paula Jean Ferri, and not have them have to filter through a million Jessica Smiths because there's that many of us.
It's like with Twitter, I have a very unique name and I was able to use my name as my username on so many things. Like, it's just nice having that.
Yeah, for sure. So something that a lot of people don't, it's something that I don't feel like a lot of people consider when they pick a pen name, but it really should. Because when I was looking at pen names, I did the research. I actually almost went with Paula Jenkins at the suggestion of a friend. There's a fitness expert who already has Paula Jenkins and has, you know, all this stuff. I didn't want to compete in her space. So I opted to change and go with something different.
I remember giving advice to someone, this was a long time ago now, back when I was still in the website business. And I remember saying, look up the website name first. Like, if you can get that name, then use that name. Like, you don't want something that you have to use a weird extension on. Just try to find the website first and then choose it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, do a quick Google search, see what comes up. I mean, with Paula Jean Ferri, there are other people named Paula Jean. There are people named Paula Ferri. You know, there might even be Jean Ferries. I don't think I saw any, but that unique combination makes me pop up first. And so you have to get to like page 6, 7, 8 of Google before you start seeing all of these other suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And well, my next question was going to be, where can listeners connect with you online? But I think we pretty much answered that question.
Yeah. I mean, Paula Jean Ferri, there I am. My handle is also typically Jess Squeaks, which might be another way to search for me as well. So JessSQueaks, three S's because I'm complicated like that.
It's like, it makes me think of a snake. Can you tell them at that stage where I'm teaching my kids like the alphabet and how to read?
Yes, absolutely. That's great. But I mean, it was just, it's just what I did. Like I squeak because that was how my Tourette's started out initially, was I just made these squeaky noises. So yes, squeaks. So I mushed them together.
Well, it was wonderful having you as a guest. I feel like we didn't cover the topic as well as we could have because we kind of went down on weird tangents, but it was a pleasure talking to you. You were a wonderful guest.
Thank you for having me. I felt like they were still kind of important. I hopefully it's still helpful in some regard.
Yes. hopefully it was helpful and at least a little entertaining to listeners who were probably wondering what the hell are they talking about now, but... Yeah, I enjoyed this.
Right? Me too. Me too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on. So join me next time when I'm going to talk to Suzanne Casamento about how she found creativity during the pandemic. Until then, keep reading, keep writing, and go do what you do best. You got this. Read and Write Podcast is edited and produced by Deborah Zebarth. Theme music was written and performed by Jay Hunger. Audio effects were created by Red Octopus and Black River Phonogram. Show notes and previous episodes can be found at readandwritepodcast.com. Special thanks to Jessica Smith and all the subscribers who make this podcast possible. And that's it. Thank you for listening to the show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate Read and Write on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, drop me a line. I'm always open to suggestions. Also, did you know that Read and Write publishes 3 episodes a week? Check out the podcast's YouTube channel for Write With Me Mondays live streams and 30-second book reviews on Fridays.